Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us again for our podcast. My name is Mark Klingsheim, and we're happy to have with us this week David Berkus. David has been recognized as one of the world's top business thinkers. He was selected to the Thinkers 50. He's a best-selling author and speaker, and his TED Talk has been viewed by over 2 million people. He's written for publications such as the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and Fast Company. He's going to be sharing some thoughts from his most recent book entitled Pick a Fight, and we're looking forward to our conversation with David. Yes, first off, David, could you give us just a little bit of your story? I don't think I've ever heard kind of, I know you're from Philadelphia, and so you're representing from there, but tell us a little bit about how you got to do what you're doing.
Yeah, so born and raised in Philadelphia, Holy Redeemer Hospital, technically Meadowbrook, but you know. So grew up there. I actually lived outside of Boston for a little while. As well, but I never became a Patriots fan for no reason other than want of suffering. I stayed loyal to all Philly sports instead of going loyal to Boston, and it's been pretty rough. But anyway, when I was, I guess you could start it when I was 17, 18 years old. I went to undergrad. I went to university thinking I wanted to be a writer. Right. And when you're that young, you think writing is just fiction, right? Because that's all you've read. Nonfiction to you is textbooks. They're boring. They're not what you want to do. You think fiction, right? So I went in with the grand existential crisis of, do I become a literary novelist and starve but be recognized as brilliant, or like a James Patterson trade fiction person and sell out but be... And in reality, I ended up with neither, because it was in school taking classes in a variety of different creative writing that I found narrative nonfiction. People like Gladwell and the people that even came before him that did an amazing job telling stories that were actually true and then extracting out principles that were actually helpful. And I noticed something really interesting, which was that these books tended to sell better. And then people would actually pay money to hear those people come tell the same story that's in the book, which is just, from a business model standpoint, you're like, this is way better than being a novelist.
Right, right.
I mean, some of it was also just the pleasure of writing something that is helpful as opposed to just entertaining. I mean, entertainment is helpful for sure, but is broadly more applicable. And so I came out of undergrad going, wow, that's amazing. I want to do that, right? And so I went to graduate school pretty much right away to study organizational psychology to learn how to write, like how to learn about this thing that I wanted to write about in order to be helpful. I finished that master's degree and got really, really bored. So I actually started a doctorate. I had no intention of being a professor whatsoever. Candidly, I was also married to a medical student. So I had a lot of time on my hands while she was studying. So I just, I wanted there to be two Dr. Berkuses instead of just one. Right. So I went into graduate school for that with this idea of wanting to write about all this sort of stuff. And, through a couple of different interesting pivots, dramatic change in the economy that happened around 2008, 2009, I ended up, hey, I'm qualified to teach. And this is a place that is weathering the economic storm. So I ended up in a full-time professor role for about 10 years. I am now still full-time appointment, but not, I don't teach full-time because the speaking schedule and all that has been crazy. So I sort of say I'm on a semi-permanent sabbatical. As long as I check in and run a couple classes throughout the year, they haven't fired me yet. They don't pay me what they used to, but they haven't fired me yet, which is great. But really the majority of what I do is writing nonfiction works, trying to blend storytelling and science and offer up something that is helpful. And when the opportunity to go travel around and speak and talk about that presents itself, I take it. Of course, right now as we're recording this, the world ended. So none of that is happening other than the writing, which has been really fun. I mean, I literally have gotten, this new book came out 2 months ago, and I have gotten, just today, I got an email from someone that said, so what's your next book? And I was like, at first I was trying to understand the motivations of it. And then I realized, oh yeah, everybody's read all of, like, their to read list is done, right? Right? Because we're all at home catching up on our stack by our bedside, and I should get to work because some people have already finished reading everything I got and want more. So that's been good.
Good. Well, tell us a little bit of the story behind your present work. I finished it this last week. It's a great great listen, and tell us a little bit the story behind that.
Yeah. So after Friend of a Friend, which is the book that came out before, I mean, all the through line through all of my work, really, even though it's hard to spot, is teams and the workplace, right? How truthfully, what I always say I'm fighting for is I'm fighting to make work not suck. I'm trying to fight for work is such a central part of all of our lives. I don't think there's such a thing as work-life balance, because if the work that you do drains you, that will have a spillover effect into all those other areas you're trying to balance. And so I've been focused in on that. And the biggest part of that affects somebody's positive or negative experience at work is teams. So I've been focused a lot on that. Between creativity, how do you manage those teams? And Friend of a Friend was about how teams form and the networks around them and that sort of thing. So that led me to this place where I was looking at, okay, well, what explains what causes teams to get bonded together, to get motivated together, to get aligned and all speaking the same language? And there was a ton of research out there, or there was a ton of literature out there about the research on mission and vision and purpose and all that sort of thing. But I felt like there was a lack, which is that we all talk about how great a motivating vision can be, an inspiring cause can be. And we very rarely talk about the fact that a lot of times what actually motivates people to start pursuing that vision is actually the vision of what the opposite could look like, right? It's the stakes element. It's not just that here's this future that we see, it's that if we don't start hustling, this thing is going to happen. So I started really drilling down on that common enemy idea, that common threat, that negative future that could happen if we don't get to work. And that's where I sort of arrived at this idea of the book is called Pick a Fight, but this idea that the smart leaders that really rally their people around a mission, a purpose, a cause, don't just say, here's my vision, do you want to buy into it? Right? They provide people an answer to the question, what are you fighting for? What are you fighting to change in the world? What evil or injustice or environmental risk, whatever it is, what are you trying to remove from the world that we are all working together to do? Those are really what separates just having a purpose or a mission and having one that really does motivate and align a team. Fight is admittedly a controversial thing to call it, right? I mean, anybody who was in business in the 1980s is so tired of the war metaphors and the battle metaphors between competitors. So we had to get really clear that that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about revolutions, reformations, crusades. We're talking about trying to change the world. But when there are stakes to that lack of change, I don't know a better term to use than a fight. We are literally fighting for that future, because if we don't win, this future will happen. And it is a far more catastrophic thing than just lack of achieving our vision.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about just the thoughts. I know you wrote this before all this developed, as far as with the pandemic and kind of a central enemy for worldwide. You know, it's, yeah. I've heard, you know, people comparing it to World War II and others have said, yeah, well, and I think I heard you say this on another show that was one half of the world against another, where we have a common enemy right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I don't know that we've ever had in world history a truly sort of global enemy. I mean, we've had pandemics before, but let's be honest, we in the West tend not to care because they tend to disproportionately affect developing nations. This one got us to care. My hope, of course, is that we care about those developing nations that every 2 years are fighting a different, whether it's Ebola or H1N1 or those sort of things, right? So there's that issue. But yeah, I don't know that I've ever seen it. I mean, certainly in my lifetime, I've never seen the entire world come together like that. And the pace of innovation that's happened as we're fighting this. I mean, you know, I heard somebody pushing back on this idea. We talk about we need a vaccine and it'll be 18 months to a vaccine. And everybody's going, well, where did you get that number? Because the fastest vaccine that's ever been produced took 5 years. And well, I mean, me personally, I get that number because we've never had the entire world and every pharmaceutical and biotech company working on the same thing. I think it'll be shorter than that personally. I mean, I don't want to make those predictions because predictions about the future tend to get really tricky. I'll stick to predictions about the past. But we've never really seen that. And it was weird. I mean, I didn't plan this. And nobody knew. The book came out. I started writing the book last year. I was sort of in my own underdog fight about wanting to get the message out and pushing against some things. So I wrote it before I even knew how I was going to get it out there. Mm-hmm. And my proof that I was not planning on this being, I mean, I feel like it really is a timely message. But my proof that I didn't plan on it is that we released it only in Audible. Right? An audiobook only, under the idea that more and more leaders are reading with their ears. They're listening to podcasts like this one. They're listening to audiobooks because they're trying to consume some new ideas into the busy, already busy spaces in their life, like their commute and other stuff. And of course, nobody's commuting anymore, right? So if I were planning it, I would have planned it a whole lot better. But you know, the big thing I'm trying to do now because of that timeliness of that message is this idea that we all see that power. Like it's a beautiful case study of the power of rallying people together towards a common good and against a common threat. I don't like the term enemy, but threat is a solid term because that can be something non-human, right? That's not, enemy implies organization. This can be a different threat. I love that idea. My big question for leaders now, though, is what happens when it's over, right? When we win this, and we will win it, what are you going to do to bring that same level of purpose to people's everyday life as it sort of goes back to normal? Or are you just going to fall back into the traditional fight against competitors, fight for market share rhetoric? I think that's a huge mistake because we've seen the power of what happens when you focus on fighting for something bigger.
Now, in your book, you've identified three fights. Can you walk us through those just quickly and maybe give some examples?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing we do in the book is we lay out that grand thesis, right? That a common threat and fighting for a bigger future are what bond and motivate people. They create a sense of group identity. They reaffirm sacred values. But they beg the question, okay, how do we know we're in the right fight? Because leaders have to pick a fight, but they have to pick the right fight. And so I scoured the research on, in terms of, we talk about motivation often in terms of extrinsic and intrinsic, right? But in terms of just intrinsic motivation, what are the levers that you can pull? What are the things as a leader you can do to sort of increase intrinsic motivation in your people? And that's where I arrived at these three sort of archetypes of fights. They're all drawn from different levers of motivation, but they're different ways to sort of express it. They're templates, if you will, or they're Mad Libs you can use, right? To just plug in certain places in the blank and know that you're doing that based on a bunch of research, but a little bit simpler to understand. So the three fights are the revolutionary fight, the underdog fight, and the ally fight. And the revolutionary fight is what I've been hinting at most of the time. It's what I think is truthfully the most inspiring. The ally fight might be a close second, but all of that is through my own bias. I will say it's the one a lot of leaders think that they're in. And we can talk about what to do if you think you're in the wrong fight in a second. But the revolutionary fight quite simply says that the entire industry or the status quo or society as a whole finds this acceptable, and we refuse to accept that. We refuse to accept it because it's an injustice, or we refuse to accept that because it's an environmental risk, or it's just unfair, or it's not in the best interest of the customers, whatever it is, right? The entire industry says this, and we refuse to accept that. One of my favorite examples of that is, and I just put out a video about this actually, is Paul O'Neill and Alcoa. Paul O'Neill turned around Alcoa in the 1990s by basically saying, hey, you know what? The whole manufacturing industry has this idea of acceptable risk. And I find any risk unacceptable. We're going to go for being a zero accident company. That's hugely motivating to people. What it also happened to do was turn around the stock price of Alcoa, which was tanking because they had inefficiencies in their production process. They weren't managing inventory properly. They weren't doing a bunch of different stuff that safety correlated to. And so O'Neill's grand idea was that nobody's going to be motivated by, we need to raise the stock price. But what they will be motivated by is the idea of, we're trying to make this place safer for you and for your coworkers, et cetera. The whole industry finds this risk acceptable. We refuse to accept that. And when O'Neill left, he had quadruple and then whatever five times is, that's the word I'm looking for, the revenue of Alcoa just by producing more with less, just by creating those process efficiencies, becoming known as a better quality producer because they were also a safer producer. So that's the revolutionary fight. When you can point to the industry and the way that they settle and say something is acceptable and you say, no, that's no longer acceptable, you've got a revolution. The underdog fight is my Philly roots, actually. I mean, it's quite literally the fight to prove the haters and the naysayers wrong, right? You're in an underdog fight when you are rejected and you have a rebuttal to that rejection. It's not enough to just be the small person, right? Because there's some truth to that, and that can actually have a demotivating effect because you'll say, oh, we'll never win, right? You have to have both that rejection and the rebuttal. Well, you're wrong because of this, right? So, I mean, like I said, I'm a Philly boy. Our greatest sports hero, for example, for the whole city of Philadelphia, is a fictional character who loses a boxing match, right? Rocky Balboa. But if you remember in the very first Rocky, now there's like 11. I don't even know how many there are anymore. Right. If you remember in the very first Rocky, he tells Adrian, I don't want to win. I just want to go to the distance because no one's ever done that. I want to prove that I'm not a bum by going the distance. And that was his plan. His plan was literally to just take a beating, to outlast him, right? So that's the underdog fight. You know you're in an underdog fight when you have the rejection and the rebuttal. If you just have the rejection, then you got some work to do. And then the last one is the ally fight, which quite simply says it's not about our fight at all. It's about their fight and what they're fighting for, and we help them. You get to define them however you want. Them can be a customer. A lot of times it's a patient, like in a healthcare organization. It can even be the company. So one of the most admirable companies that I've ever found, been privileged to get to know the CEO of WD-40 company, Gary Ridge. And Gary Ridge, if you ask them, what are you fighting for? They'll tell you we're fighting for each other, right? I mean, think about WD-40. It's a fundamentally uninspiring product, right? It's oil. It's just oil. And they only sell it. They have one product. And yet it's this, it's amazing. Everybody has a can of WD-40 somewhere. Like, it's this amazing thing. We're excited about it because they're excited about it. But what gets them excited about it is that that oil, that can, represents the opportunity to create a company where everybody can play to their strengths, where everybody can really thrive, where everybody knows what they need to work on to develop into better people. Like, Gary has really done an amazing job making what WD-40 is fighting for is this family. They use the term tribe, right? So, the ally fight is, it's not about our fight, it's about their fight, but you get to define they however you want.
That's good. So if
that was my, I don't know how long, by the way, that was not rehearsed, but that was like one, I think I did the whole thing in one breath.
Yeah.
So how was that?
That's great. So I was going to ask you if you have a picture of yourself on the stairs holding your, in Philadelphia, holding your arms up. That
I'm sure I do if I go back young enough. I'm trying to think of the last time I've been to the Museum of Art in Philadelphia, and maybe I need to go back just to get that picture. Normally, my experience with Philadelphia right now is I fly into their airport and then I drive to the Jersey Shore and go to the beach with my family every year. So unfortunately, my experiences of Philly as the inner city of Philly are pretty minimal right now.
So if you're a young leader, and we have a number of leaders that maybe are first-time leaders, what are some things that they can do? Some practical things that they can do to, again, identify the fight, you know, working with their team as far as, and again, they're not the leader of the whole organization, but they've got a team that they're leading.
Yeah. So, you know, okay. One of the big mistakes we make to a lot of young leaders, whether that be college age leaders, student leaders, or whether that's you're an employee leading yourself, or even you're in mid 30s and you're handed that first sort of management role, we give them all this advice about casting a vision that I just think is inaccurate, right? Because the visions that truly inspire people, you don't cast that and say, here's my vision, and then go get buy-in to it. What the great leaders do is put to words the vision that's already in the hearts and minds of other people, right? So your job as that first-time leader, or really at any level, your first thing you need to do when it comes to identifying the fight is to figure out what fight people will already resonate with. The advice that I love to give people is to go one by one to all of your people and ask them two questions, which will not only research how well your mission and purpose is established, but give you some hints on whether or not what's the right fight is. The two questions are, what do we do here? And how does what you do help us do that? What do we do here is quite simply a test of how well the actual organizational purpose, whether you have a right to change it or not, how well that is actually resonating with people. If you get a diversity of answers, that's actually a bad thing in this case, right? Mm-hmm. You get a uniformity of answers, that means, hey, this organization's done a pretty good job at least letting people know what the mission and purpose is. The second question is whether or not they've internalized it, right? How does what you do help us do that? And that's going to be your biggest job as that first line, that frontline manager, that first time manager, is actually helping people translate the big high up fight to the work that they do every single day. So how well people can answer that question tells you how much work you have to do in that regard. Now, I will say, if there's a diversity of different answers, and if there's not a lot of strong answers to that question, like there's not a uniformity of answers to the how does what you do, there's some hints in there that can be helpful. If when people answer these questions, they talk a lot about customers, for example, that's a really strong signal that the ally fight might be the right fight to use in your language and your rhetoric, because people are already paying attention to how they help customers. Mm-hmm. If it's about the industry and how we're different from them, or how they're wrong, or how we're better, or something like that, that's a hint at that revolution fight, right? And then in terms of an organization, I think the underdog fight, it's really up to you to use it, whether or not you want to use it as We're the underdog of the whole industry, which might not be possible, or we're the underdog team. Everybody in the organization is undercounting us, and here's how we're going to prove them wrong. But really, a lot of times you're going to find, based on their answers, that the revolutionary fight or the ally fight is really what resonates with them. That the trick is to know that you're picking the right one based on what resonates with them. I've worked with a ton of leaders in the last year that really thought they were a revolution, and you find out their people are more motivated by being an ally, right? So then you've got to change your rhetoric to make sure that you are resonating with what they're already motivated by. Mm-hmm. So those two questions again: what do we do here? How does what you do help us do that?
Have you found that different generations are motivated differently by certain fights? Have you in your research?
You know, I haven't found that yet. I do think there's a generational difference in terms of how important being able to name that fight is. There's a lot of research, for example, looking at the millennial generation and Gen Z. I almost hate using the term millennial now because the oldest millennials are turning 40 this year, right? So it just feels a little weird to talk about them that way. But there is some sense that the revolutions idea and overall just this mission drivenness is, it resonates with them a bit more. It's something that, I mean, since 20 years ago, when we started doing research on what millennials want in the workplace, that mission and purpose was already there. Whether or not that's a revolution or an ally, again, it depends on the industry, depends on the individual person and the overall, like the percentage of how well it resonates with those different people. So no, I don't know that I've seen this fight works for this generation, but I have definitely seen that the younger generations of the workplace want that sense of mission and purpose. Or maybe every generation wants it the same. Maybe it's just that millennials and Gen Z are arrogant enough to ask for it on their frontline job, right? And Gen X and boomers were willing to wait a while and pay their dues, and millennials are impatient. Because I mean, I do think everybody wants that sense of mission and purpose in the work, but I do know that the millennials and Gen Z are speaking up and demanding it much louder than anybody else.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Talk a little bit about some of your previous work just briefly, so that, you know, I think part of people that now are finding themselves unemployed, furloughed, a lot of different things going on. I know you have a book called Friend of a Friend around networking. And what I've found is a lot of executives will, give me a call and say, you know, I haven't really kept my network strong. I've just kind of been focused on my work, and now I'm out of work and I need to get that network working again. Yeah. Give us just a couple minutes just on that, as far as kind of the importance. And I know you have kind of a different way of looking at as far as networking.
Yeah. So, I mean, the core idea of Friend of a Friend is that the world didn't need another networking advice book. Right? Another sort of, for lack of a better term, memoirs of a power networker, right? Which is what most of them are. And they're good. Those are valuable. Like, it's great. It's like the CEO memoirs. It's fun to read them. I don't know that I would ever emulate a CEO's advice because it was that particular person in that particular organization, but I would look at lots of them and then go, let me tailor a plan for me. So I feel like that's what the world needed more when it came to networking. So what I did was I did a deep dive into the world of network science. I happen to already be really fascinated by it, so that made it a whole lot easier. And look at what are the principles that are universally true about networks, right? And unfortunately, I think a lot of people associate networking with going to events, with meeting people in person, with meeting lots of different people. I mean, fundamentally for most people, networking equals meeting strangers, right? Which is also why I think most people, I mean, there's some research that actually supports this. Most people feel dirty or morally tainted when they're asked to engage in a networking event, right? And this is introverts and extroverts. That your personality type doesn't have anything to do on, right? So the big reframe that I try to get through in Friend of a Friend is that it's not actually your network. You don't have a network, can't grow your network, can't build your network. There's just the network and you are a part of it. And what you want, or the way to get what you want, is to figure out how to navigate through that network. And you're exactly right. The approach that most of us take is we only do that organically, or a better term might be serendipitously. We just do our work, and if we happen to meet new people or reconnect with old people or form strong ties with people, any of the things that we do to move our position inside the larger network happen to be a byproduct instead of something intentional around the network. And so what happens a lot of people at all levels, really, but executives for sure, because people come to them so often. And then as soon as they don't have the chair, nobody cares about them anymore. They care about the chair, right? And so that can be a gross wake-up call. So, I mean, I'll tell you that the number one thing that I do to pull advice out of that, there's a bunch of different network science principles we talk about in that. But for people who are, A, looking to do this remotely, which we all are because we're all, you know, you can't exactly go fly to that conference because the conference isn't there. But also to sort of re-engage your network. The two biggest principles that I offer people, there's this idea that you should reconnect with your dormant ties. People you know, but you don't know that well. Former colleagues, people that you used to see all of the time, but didn't take the time to do. I don't believe that you should go, hey, I'm out of work and I need your help. The time to ask for that is after you've built up a little bit of rapport in that regard. I will say that as we're recording this in the midst of this madness, I have never seen a time, just like I've never seen a time where we're all engaged in a global fight, I've never seen a time where a simple 5-word email can go a long way. I think you could reach back out to any former colleague, any old friend, anybody you feel like, oh, I really need to reconnect with that person. And you could literally email them, how are you holding up? And you'd be amazed at how the conversation goes, right? And they might ask you how you're holding, and then you could talk about what you need. But just that idea of like, hey, it's an absolutely crazy time right now, and I was thinking about you today, and I wouldn't be able to forgive myself if I didn't check in with you and see how you're holding up and how you're doing. Pretty much everybody will receive that right now with no other agenda, which is great, right? So that's the first thing, reach back out to those dormant ties. The second thing I would encourage a lot of people to do is explore the fringe of your network. Now is the time to be asking the question, who do you know in blank? With blank being that industry you want to get to know more people in, that sector you want to know more people about, maybe it's a city you know you're headed to, even if it's just on a vacation, but there might be opportunities to meet new people there. Who do you know in blank, with blank being whatever you want to get to know more people in? You ask that of a lot of the people that you're close to, the people you are comfortable talking to, and what you'll find is they'll give you lists of names of people who are one degree of separation out from you, if we want to use the network science term. I say degree of separation, everybody thinks 6 degrees of separation or 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, right? And those stuff are true. I mean, there's a ton of research we talk about in a book that actually proves that idea. I'm just not interested in the 5 or 6 handshakes I need to meet the prime minister of any country, actually. I don't want to meet any of them. What I am interested in is just the math on how many millions, if not tens of millions of people are one degree of separation. And we tend to go the wrong approach on this. We tend to identify a person and then sort of LinkedIn stalk them, right? And see that we have this person in common. Then we go beg that person for an introduction. And that person doesn't want to introduce us because whatever reason, right? And we end up at that dead end and then we get frustrated and stop. Instead of asking a lot of different people, hey, who do you know in blank, and letting them pro-offer potential introductions, potential new connections, et cetera. So those two things, reach back out to dormant ties, who do you know in blank, explore. I call that exploring the fringes of your network, the people that are one degree out from the network that you're already sensing. Now is a great time, even if you don't act on it, now is a great time to just learn what is one degree out from you in terms of opportunity and potential. Hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's practical advice. And I get in our industry, I get resumes and calls every week. And it's, you definitely need to be doing that, not only in crisis, but all the time, just to reach out and be able to help somebody else out and not just when you're in need. Talk a little bit as far as during this time. I think a lot of people are probably losing focus. It's hard for them to, they're working from home. You mentioned you're the dean of your kid's school now.
And Burke Academy, we call it. Yeah. Right.
So, there's a lot going on in people's lives that they typically don't have to navigate, but how are you staying focused as far as on your work? And
yeah. So believe it or not, here's the hack that I've used basically. And then I'll unpack it. Every day at 10 a.m., I jump on a Zoom call with two people. Sometimes it's 4 or 5 people. And we all say hi to each other. And then if you think about the boxes all turn into the top of our head. We all say hello, and then we all just start writing or start creating or start working on something. And what I love is the accountability of it, right? Because if I'm distracted or if I'm suddenly gone from my window, right? Somebody's going to jump on and call me out. Where are you? It's writing time right now, right? Now it's creating time. So I love that. The other thing is it's technically an appointment, right? It goes on my calendar of the importance level that I need to keep this appointment. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing that every day. And truthfully, after that, I've basically the biggest thing that I've been practicing is just forgiveness that the other stuff falls by the wayside. You know, no one is expecting when we all suddenly had to Zoom in and work from home and do all that sort of stuff. anybody that expected the level of your productivity to stay the same is just unrealistic, right? Yep. So it's really been, I have that dedicated hour. It's on my calendar. Usually it's like we get breakfast in the morning, then I check in on that, and I come out of that and we do the homeschool stuff with the boys. And then if, like we're doing today, because we're recording this in the afternoon, if I can get anything else in the day, that's a bonus. But as long as I keep my appointment with those four people, those five people, and get that 1 hour of focus time done, I call that a pretty good day.
Yeah, no, that I haven't heard anybody. Well, I have heard people doing that as far as with Zoom, kind of feeling like you're not working alone. You've got at least some others that they're doing the same thing, and that motivational factor. Tell us a little bit what outside of work, and I was asking somebody the other day, what do you do outside of work? And they said, well, I'm at home. I don't do much. But if you had a normal day, once things are back to normal, what do you do to recharge? What are some of your interests?
Yeah. I mean, my biggest, by way of a hobby would be, for the last 14 years, I have trained in this esoteric martial art known as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. If you ever watch the UFC or mixed martial arts fights, jiu-jitsu is what you do once those guys fall over, right? All this stuff on the ground that nobody understands, but who's on top and whatever, that's all jiu-jitsu. And it's been great for health and fitness and all that sort of stuff. I actually, when I got my black belt about 3 years ago in that, I started really reframing it and realizing that there was this trend, you've probably seen it too, this trend to encourage leaders to have more mindfulness. And now there's like 17 different guided meditation apps and all that sort of stuff. And ultimately, jiu-jitsu is a fantastic form of mindfulness, right? Because when some other guy is trying to choke you unconscious with your own clothes, you can't be worried about something else in the office or something your kid said to you as you were. You have to be in the moment and mindful, right? So I've really benefited that in a normal day. That's usually a part of my day too. So like a normal day is getting my kids off to school. Then I do the focus writing time alone, no accountability. Although I might keep this group thing because I'm really liking it. Then during the lunch hour, I run off and go train that. And then I come back and do what I call reactive work, interviews, phone calls, all of that sort of stuff. So I fit it into that normal day. And that's really candidly, because I have an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old, that's really the only hobby I have time
sure,
for.
Sure. What parting advice would you give a leader during this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think truthfully, I think just about everybody should be questioning assumptions, questioning mental models. I'm a huge fan of Roger Martin. He's an intellectual hero of mine who really coined this term integrative thinking. When it looks like two mental models are in conflict, maybe there is a way to get them to actually fit together, right? And I mean, I spent 10 years in higher education where basically everybody said online is a reduction of quality. And then this semester, we're forced into a way to keep quality and do online, which proves that conflict was always in our head. It wasn't actually in reality. And so Martin called it integrative thinking. That's one of the biggest things I encourage a lot of people to do, is somewhere in your life, there is an assumption that I can't have this and this. And in reality, that assumption might just be in your head. So I think constantly question it. Now, you might search every possible angle and find, no, they actually are in conflict. I cannot eat donuts every day and also be fit, right? but I can, but the donuts taste terrible, right? So there might be some things that actually are in conflict, but a lot of them are actually just in our head.
Well, thanks, David. This has been, I've enjoyed our conversation, and definitely looking forward for our audience to hear your thoughts. And I know it's going to be helpful for them, and wish you success in your career and your next project that you're working at.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about David's work, please visit davidburkus.com. Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.